9. London, England, October 31st, 1776, noon. King George is savoring victory. More than 3,000 miles from New York, the 38-year-old monarch sits enthroned in the British House of Peers, just moments away from delivering his opening address to Parliament. The ceiling is vaulted, making for unreliable acoustics, and the great walls are covered in tapestries celebrating the defeat of the Spanish Armada more than one century ago. Arrayed before the throne are the leaders of England, many sitting on padded benches known as woolsacks. Those men belonging to the House of Lords wear scarlet wool robes trimmed in white miniver fur, while members of the House of Commons stand in the back of this great room with its vaulted ceiling with the non-legislative spectators, dressed without ceremony. The members receive no salary for their time in Parliament and must rely on a second profession to make a living. Footnote: members of the House of Commons did not begin receiving a salary until 1911. End footnote. It has been more than 4 months since King George last addressed this distinguished body as part of the annual closing of Parliament, delivering a speech in which he took great pains to focus his attention on the war in America. "We are engaged in a great national cause, the prosecution of which must inevitably be attended with many difficulties and much expense," he stated on May 23rd. As is usual in Parliament, his voice was drowned out by dissenters shouting their opinions. "I will still entertain a hope that my rebellious subjects may be awakened to a sense of their errors, and that, by a voluntary return to their duty, they will justify me in bringing about the favorite wish of my heart, the restoration of harmony and re-establishment of order in every part of my dominion." "But," the king then sternly warned, "if a due submission should not be obtained from such motives and such dispositions on their part, I trust that I shall be able, under the blessing of Providence, to effectuate it by a full exertion of the great force with which you have entrusted me." That final threat troubles many in Parliament's minority Whig party. They believe in reconciliation, not extermination. To some, however, the Whig argument borders on treason, implying, as they believe it does, that the troubles in America were brought on by King George himself and his punitive treatment of the colonists. Moments before the summer recess was officially convened, outspoken Whig politician David Hartley introduced a motion that Parliament should not recess at all, for fear that a lengthy summer break would allow the king to pursue his war policies without parliamentary oversight. Footnote: Hartley was a good friend of Benjamin Franklin, whom he met and socialized with during Franklin's tenure in London. End footnote. Hartley's motion was immediately rejected, though not for reasons that had anything to do with politics. June through September finds London at its humid, fetid worst, and many politicians want it out. Heat accentuates the body odor of the unwashed poor. Lice infestations are rampant. There is no such thing as public sanitation, so residents simply empty chamber pots onto the streets, allowing the aroma of fecal matter to mingle with the stench of rotting garbage, scraps of offal thrown away by the local butchers, and the carcasses of dead cats, dogs, and horses. In addition, the common man in London often quenches his thirst by drinking from the murky brown waters of the River Thames, which also serves as the city's raw sewage and factory waste dump. Thus, each year, London is plagued by an epidemic of dysentery and diarrhea. Many citizens, seeking to avoid these maladies, prefer to douse their thirst with copious amounts of cheap gin. Footnote: gin has been often wrongly identified as a British invention. The liquor was first distilled in Holland and became popular in England only when Dutch-born William of Orange sat on the British throne in the late 17th century. At one point in the 18th century, an estimated 8,000 vendors sold cheap and often lethal doses of high-proof liquor on the streets of London. Soon, the government outlawed the gin street vendors, but through the years, gin and tonic became one of the world's most popular cocktails. That happened because around the world, British subjects dissolved anti-malarial quinine tablets into carbonated water and then mixed this tonic water with gin to hide the taste. End footnote. Prior to the summer recess, Parliament was united in the belief that the colonies must remain British. Yet members were torn over how to make this possible. The Tory majority, loyal to the King, believed war to be the only answer. In their opinion, prisoners of war should be shipped to the British colony in India and the rebel leadership hanged to prevent further uprisings. But the Whig minority insisted that the American colonists were still British citizens. Thus, they were in favor of giving in to the colonists' demands for parliamentary representation and rescinding some of the punitive, coercive acts. On July 8th, a casually transmitted line of information from General William Howe to King George changed the political landscape. "I am informed that the Continental Congress have declared the United Colonies free and independent states." King George and the vast majority of Parliament were outraged. There would be no reconciliation. Then, in mid-August, the entire Declaration of Independence was published in the newspaper The London Chronicle. Public reaction was swift and angry, with many British citizens viewing the document as nothing more than a clever justification for treason. A typical comment came from Ambrose Searle, the civilian secretary to Admiral Richard Howe, an elder brother of General William Howe. He wrote that the declaration proclaims the villainy and madness of these deluded people. Footnote: General Howe and his elder brother Richard were authorized by King George to broker peace with the colonists. On September 11, 1776, the two met with John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and Edward Rutledge in what has since been labeled the Staten Island Peace Conference. The sticking point, of course, was the Declaration of Independence. General Howe demanded that the colonists rescind the document before peace talks moved forward. The colonial representatives refused. End footnote. Most public opinion centered on the two opening paragraphs which justify independence and introduce the unique notion that free men should be accorded the pursuit of happiness, an absurd concept to Britain's impoverished masses, a group numbering roughly 3/4 of the island's population, most of whom can neither read nor comment on the declaration. Almost all of them are doomed to a life of misery and want, thanks to a social structure that prevents upward mobility from one class to another. Seeking to keep wealth and power for themselves, the British upper class makes quality education a constant for their children, yet none is provided for the working man who can ill afford to pay tuition. Footnote: the first census in the British Isles took place in 1801, with the combined population of England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales numbering 15.7 million people. The population for Great Britain during the American Revolution can only be estimated, but it is believed nearly 1 million called London home. End footnote. To King George, the declaration is a personal affront. By far, the document's lengthiest passage consists of 18 blistering accusations against the King's character and policies. The words chosen by Thomas Jefferson are deliberately provocative, designed to publicly humiliate a monarch who revels in the fantasy that his colonial subjects universally adore him. Now, as the Declaration begins to make its way around Europe, Jefferson's disrespect raises questions about how King George will fight back. While the war is certainly preoccupying George, he is also harboring a secret. His mental health is in decline. The King has become prone to long, disjointed discussions with members of his royal court, veering uncontrollably and without warning from one topic to another. The same can be seen in his writing, where sometimes single sentences ramble on for a full page. George now has trouble sleeping, and his vision is beginning to blur. So far, neither the King nor any of his advisers sees these symptoms as anything more than duress. There is the stress of the colonial war, along with Queen Charlotte having brought their 11th child into the world 6 months ago. George's reputation as a learned and passionate husband, father, and ruler guarantees that his behavior will go unquestioned until it becomes too late. Very soon, the king's descent into madness will begin in earnest. Behavior that is now merely eccentric will be replaced by violent, manic episodes and ultimately confinement to a straitjacket. Footnote. The disease, which researchers believe was caused by a blend of hereditary porphyria and the arsenic used not only to powder his ceremonial wigs, but also to treat his mental health, reached its peak in 1789 when Thanksgiving services for his recovery were held at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. It went into remission for many years, but never fully disappeared. More episodes of manic, incoherent behavior between 1801 and 1810 resulted in his being removed from the throne. His son, the Prince of Wales, George Augustus Frederick, succeeded him as George IV. George III spent the last 10 years of his life suffering from blindness, rheumatism, and dementia. End footnote. But on this last day in October, as the king formally opens Parliament, he is the very image of a regal monarch. For 2 long months he has kept his emotions in check, refraining from a public response to the Declaration of Independence. But soon he will parry the words of Thomas Jefferson. With any luck, British troops will capture Jefferson and the other backers of the Declaration before the year ends. When that happens, the king will personally see to it that the tall Virginian hangs. No one insults the King of England. King George uses the power of optics to appear as authoritative as possible, sitting before Parliament in his ermine robes, wearing a heavy crown of gold, pearls, and diamonds. "My lords and gentlemen," he states by way of greeting. His voice is loud and his delivery polished. Today, much more than on most days, he feels his full power as monarch. Footnote. George III's robes were made by Ede and Ravenscroft, a London shop then owned by Martha and William Shudall. The shop had held the royal warrant for robe-making since 1694. It is still in business on Chancery Lane in London, currently serving as robe-maker and tailor to Queen Elizabeth II, the Prince of Wales, and the Duke of Edinburgh. End footnote. "Nothing could have afforded me so much satisfaction as to have been able to inform you at the opening of this session that the troubles which have so long distracted my colonies in North America were at an end, and that my unhappy people, recovered from their delusion, had delivered themselves from the oppression of their leaders and returned to their duty." The king pauses, knowing that his words will go down in history. The British Empire is larger than the Roman Empire of 2,000 years ago. A group of rabble-rousers cannot and will not be allowed to form its own nation. The king's demeanor is bolstered by news from America. As almost every legislator in this room knows, the war has been nothing short of a spectacular success. British forces now control not just Long Island, but, having crossed over into Manhattan, all of New York City. In the north, Canada is now safely in British hands. Much of this is due to inept rebel leadership, particularly George Washington. While General Howe can do no wrong for the British, Washington's army stumbles from one humiliating defeat to another. The British military leadership refuses to even acknowledge Washington as having military rank because they don't recognize the government that granted it to him. Thus, they even refuse to state his rank in their written requests for surrender. Rather than general, Howe refers to Washington by the title of Esquire. But the king must be careful. The denunciations made in the Declaration by Thomas Jefferson are so personal that he must not even acknowledge them, lest he appear vulnerable in the face of criticism. So he goes to the heart of the matter. He intends to warn not only the rebels, but also the powers of France and Spain, that the American threat cannot be tolerated. "If their treason be suffered to take root, much mischief must grow from it to the safety of my loyal colonies, to the commerce of my kingdoms, and indeed to the present system of all Europe. No people ever enjoyed more happiness or lived under a milder government than those now revolted provinces." Finally, putting his own spin on Thomas Jefferson's Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, the King concludes on a paternal note. "My desire is to restore to them the blessings of law and liberty equally enjoyed by every British subject, which they have fatally and desperately exchanged for the calamities of war." Parliament erupts in shouts and applause. The King is pleased. Soon his tormentors will die by the rope, as they should.